Hi. Missed you. You're back. Since it's your birthday soon, you just put your back there. Sorry, don't put along. So, yes, that is interesting. Spoilers! You'll get to see the next slide every time. Oh, we're going to try to fix it real quick. Well, while we do, I will remind you that we will be picking up our series on spiritual living again today. We are in part 5, and last time, in part 4, we started looking at a vice list in Galatians 5, right? A list of bad behaviors that don't come with an explanation of why they're bad. The audience is meant to, the original audience is meant to understand that. And it's just a list. And we started looking into each of the items on that list that precede in Galatians 5, the list we often call the fruit of the Spirit, right? The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. It's on a poster behind that wall, lest we forget. But, thank you. But when we get to turn it on, when we get to the vice list that we're dealing with in Galatians 5, this is a list of behaviors that are opposite of holiness, opposite of the things that will make Christ and God visible to other people and make us more than just intolerable snobs who think they have a better future than other people, right? That is not what Christianity is for, to make people feel better than others. The point of embracing the fruit of the Spirit is to benefit our own lives and to open their eyes in order to turn from darkness unto light and from the authority of Satan towards God, in order for them to receive forgiveness of sins and an inheritance among those made holy by faith in me, Jesus said to Paul. We are meant to make other people's lives better as God does for us and we do for each other. But there's this whole list of things in Galatians 5 about which Paul warned us, even as he had said to them before, that those who practice such things will not inherit God's kingdom. Not people who make a mistake, not people who even struggle with these things, but people who accept these things into their lives as this is the way I've decided I'm going to do it. And these things are bad ways to do life. But the deeds of the flesh are known or are evident. Porneia, which we discussed as fornication. Akatharsia, which we discussed as being corrupt, right? These are things that when they happen to us, when they happen against us, we are immediately ticked off. But Paul's argument is, be concerned about these things, not for the sake of your victimhood with regards to them, but be concerned about these things with relevance to the quality of Christian life that you're trying to embrace, rather than just worrying about your own sins. Now, those are the only two that we had done before. Today, we're going to do have another 7 on the list, and then we'll finish the list next week. Asalgeia. I am going to translate that today as licentiousness. I like this word in English because it contains part of the real nuance that Paul seems to be getting at. How many of you are familiar with the concept of moral license? A couple of you. What Paul may have been calling out here is what we call now in behavioral psychology, the notion of moral license. The notion that we do good in part, we behave well in part because of how it affects our sense of identity and how that is shadowed by the widespread human behavior that if we think we are good enough already, we may feel safe in doing something bad. It is certainly not wrong to want to look in the mirror and think, I'm a person who is going to be loving to people. I'm a person who's going to be generous to people. I'm a person who's going to be kind to people. It is good that we value good as part of who we are. But it is not a recent observation. We've been knowing that we do this for a long time, but it was studied recently in the Journal of Psychological Science in 2009, how we behave if we feel good enough already. One possibility, the study recognizes the fact of moral license, and the study done in 2009 was done to try to figure out why we do this. And here are a couple of their observations. One possibility is that the licensing effect arises because of an accrual of moral currency that we just kind of keep track of in our mind. This is how much good I've done recently. This is how well I've done recently, which allows people to more or less passively engage in more secular sorts of activities until that currency has been spent. Once you have done enough bad, you will then actually feel a debt to do good to make up for it. This is a constant and daily and practical back and forth of how humans behave in terms of morality. Researchers looking at expenditure surveys have noted that when charitable giving, this is really interesting, when charitable giving becomes more financially valuable because you can get a bigger tax break for it, churchgoers tend to give more while simultaneously attending church less. That dates to a psychological behavioral study in 2004. It was not a church effort. It's just an observation that the world made about how churches work. When we get a bigger tax break, we will give more but show up less. Isn't that interesting? It's because of moral licensing, right? It doesn't matter whether something is good. It's that we don't have to go through the endeavor of doing it because we feel good enough already. Others have found that when advisors disclose a conflict of interest to their clients, they feel at that point, licensed to give more biased advice. Isn't that interesting? So when you admit that there is already kind of a problem on the table, why not just add another? Why not just be a little more unfair in how you deal with it? This is moral license at work. Two wrongs don't make a right, but if one wrong has already happened, another is fine. This is moral licensing. Society, they conclude, this is not from the Bible. This is from a psychology research group. This is interesting. Society does not benefit from people feeling entitled to more than their share because they happen to have proved their self-worth on one prior occasion. That really good day when you behaved yourself is not currency for misbehavior. And this is specifically called out in the New Testament 2,000 years ago. Like, come on. All right. So you know it's bad. They know it's bad. Paul knows it's bad. We all know it's bad. So let's try to stop it. Yes, let's try to not behave this way. Now, next, idololatria, which literally translated, you might be able to make out the first part, idol service, idol worship. You could translate it in a single term with idolatry. And the next term, I'm going to treat these at the same time, pharmakeia. It's where we get our word for pharmacy, but it is not, you know, you're not sinning by taking Mucinex. This is referring in its context to occult medicine. So these words seem to form a pair in the list. in that they seem to have been two sides of the same coin. At the heart of both issues back in the day was a widespread religious framework, a way of looking at religion that we now call noumenism. So the entire ancient religious world functioned this way, okay? Except for the ancient Israelite religion as governed by the law of Moses in its late Bronze Age through the Iron Age and the Christianity that popped out of it. Other than that, the entire world was on board with this way of thinking, which is historically interesting in itself. That's free with your tuition. But noumenism is when you look at a facet of nature and you imagine into it some kind of divine personality. Like the thunderstorm is not a thunderstorm. It is a chariot of a given deity. A lightning bolt is not a strike of lightning. It is a weapon thrown by a god. A river is not just a river. It is the avatar of a god that when angry will grow and flood and destroy your crops. This is noumenism. It is the bestowing of divine personality onto various aspects of nature. The thing is, it doesn't just extend to the big things, like it can extend to plants and rocks and any, literally anything in creation. And you give it this identity that you then have to negotiate with. You have to sacrifice to it. You need to worship it so that you don't tick it off any further. Best case scenario, it blesses you. Second best case scenario, it leaves you alone because it's untrustworthy and fickle and damaging, right? This is noumenism. Idololatria, idol worship, was overwhelmingly used to prevent problems in daily life. If nature is an abundance of gods and divine personalities and sneaky creatures that want to harm, then the reason why you will make idols and you will do all of the idol worship things is to negotiate with them, to carve out a path for you to have a peaceful life. The other side of that, is when we submit to interpreting the nature of the world around us in terms that imbue it with powers and personas that it does not have, we will end up in a situation that puts us on a spectrum between the deluded and the demonic. Isaiah 44, verses 9 through 20. Isaiah 44, verses 9 through 20. I may not read you all of that, but I'm going to read you a section of it. Verse 9, those who fashion a graven image are all of them futile, and their precious things are of no profit. Even their own witnesses fail, like priests, you know, the people who speak for them, fail to see or know so that they will be put to shame. Who has fashioned a god or cast an idol with benefit? Isaiah asks. Behold, all his companions will be put to shame, for the craftsmen themselves are mere men. Let them all assemble themselves. Let them stand up. Let them tremble. Let them together be put to shame. Here's Isaiah's argument, God's argument through Isaiah. The man shapes iron into a cutting tool and does his work over the coals, fashioning it with hammers and working it with his strong arm. He also gets hungry and his strength fails. He drinks no water and becomes weary. Another shapes wood. He extends it with a measuring line. He outlines it with red chalk. He works with it. He works it with planes and outlines it with a compass and makes it like the form of a man, like the beauty of mankind, so that it may sit in a house. Surely he cuts cedars for himself and takes a cypress or an oak or raises it for himself among the trees of the forest. He plants a fern and the rain makes it grow. Then it becomes something for a man to burn. So he takes one of them and warms himself. He also makes a fire to bake bread. He also makes a god and worships it. He makes it a graven image and falls down before it. Half of it he burns in the fire. Other half, over half, he eats meat as he roasts a roast and is satisfied. He also warms himself and says, aha, I'm warm. I've seen the fire. But the rest of it, he makes into a god. He makes into a god. His graven image. He falls down before it and worships and also prays to it and says, deliver me, for you are my God. And Isaiah's argument is, you cut it down in the forest last week. Why are you bowing down to it now? This seems like something we should talk about, right? But this is what he's referring to in Romans 1 when he talks about how humans have this history of embracing the worship of four-footed animals and birds and image and the image of man. And Acts 17:24, we have the gospel response to this situation. Acts chapter 17, verse 24. The God who made the world and all things in it, we're going to start in verse 24 and go through verse 29. Since he is Lord of heaven and earth, doesn't dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all life and breath and all things. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live over all the face of the earth, having determined appointed times and boundaries of living, that they would seek God, if that perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he's not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and exist, even as some of your own poets have said, for we are also his children. That's quoting a first century poem to Zeus, by the way. Being then the children of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and thought of man. Therefore, having overlooked the times of ignorance, that's how he categorizes all human religious history, the times of ignorance, God is now declaring to men that all everywhere should repent. And that is the delusion that I mentioned, right? But I also said that this has a risk of being demonic. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 19 through 22. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, 19 through 22. What do I mean then? That a thing sacrificed to idols is meaningful? That an idol is meaningful? No. But I say that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not God. I don't want you to become partakers in demons. You can't drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You can't partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Or do we provoke the Lord to jealousy? We are not stronger than he. It is a scary thing, because what you are not going to ever get from me is a worldview that is absent of the supernatural. I believe in God. I believe in angels, I believe in Satan, and I believe in demons. And what Paul's scary proposition implies is that all the things that we worshiped are not just mistakes of human imagination, that they are demonically endorsed and supported in history. Like behind Zeus, there was a demon at work. Behind the cult of Artemis of the Ephesians, there was a demon at work. Behind the cult of the polytheism of India, there is a demon at work. Like, that's a scary thing. And yet, it is the reason why Paul wanted the Christians in Corinth to stop showing up for the Lord's Supper and to the sacrificial banquets at the neighborhood temples, because he didn't want them playing cat and mouse with a demon, which is scary. But there you go. Now, pharmakeia, in outside of the New Testament, where it's treated as normal, right, and not a sin, outside of the New Testament, you're normally going to see this translated in Greek literature as medicine. It's why we have the word pharmacy as we have it. When we go to Walgreens, it is not an occult store. But that's because we borrow the word from its wider Greek usage and not from the New Testament alone. Pharmakeia could be used in Greek literature to talk about medical treatment, therapy, poisoning or poison itself, a state of bewitching someone in some cases, or even distraction, like he is bewitched by that woman, right? They had the same metaphor 2,000 plus years ago. While we are certainly meant to appreciate God in all things, we need to seriously reckon our capacity to believe and our religious instinct against the nature of God and the exclusivity of his image and power generally to himself and to people, right? We don't even have superpowers, even though we have the image of God. There's a practical sense in which his divinity is not to be sought in rocks or plants or the dead or stars or any other created thing. Powers and sovereignty repackaged either for our convenience or for our dread. Let me give you a couple of quotes. This is Dioscorides, who wrote De Materia Medica. It is, to date, the biggest compendium of occult medicine that dates to the first century. It's contemporary with Paul writing 1 Corinthians, actually. It's Galatians as well. AD 50 to AD 70 is when this book was written. And here's a quote from it. He's talking about something called black hellebore. They sprinkle it around houses thinking it preserves them from evil spirits. And he doesn't necessarily think that they're wrong. He's just making an observation. And this is how you know. When they dig it, they stand praying to Apollo and Asclepius, observing the eagle's flight. For they say, the eagle flies that way, not without danger to them. For the bird causes death to anyone it sees digging hellebore. Like, the notion of occult medicine is that there's this plant you need to go out and you need to dig up. But if an eagle catches you, you are literally going to die. I mean, this is what Paul is asking us to stay away from. This is from Natural History by Pliny the Elder. The root of the peony should be dug up at night, for if any person be seen by a woodpecker of Mars, woodpeckers were the avian messenger of the god of war, while so doing, he will lose his sight. So if you pick a different plant under, if you dig a different plant in the day and the Aries woodpecker sees you, then you'll go blind. It's said about mandrakes. It is said that the person who would dig it up should avoid facing the wind, and having first traced three circles around it with a sword, should then dig it up while looking toward the west. The right eye of a frog, worn as an amulet, is said to prevent drunkenness. Its left eye, on the contrary, causes sleep. The ashes of a man's bones, taken from a pyre, are supposed to be a cure for quartan fever. Likewise, the nail parings or teeth, taken as amulets, avert disease. This is what Paul is asking us to stay away from. And you would think that this is 2,000 years old, but it's really not. Numinism has been reinvented with the absence of divine identity and the renegotiation of immanent divine power. We call it spiritualism. We call it Wicca. We call it New Age religions, and a big umbrella term. But essentially, it is numinism. we might not name gods behind it anymore, but what we are doing is we are looking at the created order, and we are bestowing upon the things that we see little packages of God's power, or someone's power, or something's power, and if we use them correctly, then we have them at our disposal, at our benefit. Divine power conveniently packaged, like Amazon nature, right? Well, we have a jungle called the Amazon, but I was talking about the company. Anyway, we'll have to move on. But ultimately, I would remind you, remember when we talked about apologetic stuff? And we talked about those philosophy questions about what would you prefer? Would you prefer a universe that has meaning, like a universe that purposes a conscientious life, or one that does not? And those of you who spoke to me after the lesson seemed to consider the point pretty soundly that you like the idea of a life that can have meaning in the universe. The only way that is possible is if something governing the universe has the conscientiousness to give it meaning for us to have a conscientious life. God must be greater than the universe, not an item within it. He must be greater than the rocks and the roots and the plants and the stars and the dead bodies and the ash and the fire. He must be greater than the wind or the storm or the things by which we would be victims of circumstance without. I had like 3 paragraphs where I really expanded on that, but I'm going to skip them because it's more like 10. But we do not live in a world in which our problems can be solved by endless beliefs in manufactured miracles of our own design. Nor are God's powers and sovereignty embedded in this world such that we can mine for God's power, grow God's power, tattoo ourselves with God's power, cut God's power, forge God's power, etc. He is not our tool. And the only way for a meaningful universe to have meaning is if he's just bigger than that. We do live in a world thoroughly to which God attends. We do live in a world that God pays attention to, in which God works for our understanding and our benefit. But the world in which he works is not his container. The world in which he works is not the measure of him. So, let's not get our theology backwards and worship the created rather than him who creates. Now, the next word, ekthraya, enmity. This is a fundamental issue, right? The willingness to hate, the willingness to build a wall. Those of you who have been on the receiving end of hate know that this is a bad thing. So I'm not going to spend a long time on this, but I will remind you of the fundamental formula that is found repeatedly in 1 John and elsewhere at points in the gospel. If someone says that he loves God, but hates his brother, he is a liar. You cannot actually have it out for someone and say, someone that God made, by the way, and say, I sure do love God. I'm crazy about him. I trust him. Well, then trust the value that he has put on that person's life. Enmity, the hatred, I could have also translated it that way, doesn't fly. Doesn't work, right? Okay. Eris is, I'm going to translate it today as strife. So, in Hyginus is Fabula, verse 92, passage 92, which was written in either the first century BC or first century AD. I want to read you this little paragraph story. When Peleus and Thetis, this is a story about the Greek gods, the Greco-Roman gods. When Peleus and Thetis were celebrating their marriage, all the gods were invited except Eris. Angry, she threw an apple into the midst of them, inscribed "for the most beautiful." Juno, Minerva, and Venus claimed the apple, all, you know, each for themselves. Jupiter ordered Mercury to lead them to Paris on Mount Ida to judge their beauty. Eris is that goddess in the story who, out of bitterness, causes bitterness for others. This is not the way. We cannot afford to be the people who encourage not competition for the sake of fun, but competition for the sake of identity. Competition for the sake of belonging. Competition for determining the value of people is dumb and rude, and I might even tack it on to hateful. Right? We can't be those people who toss the apple to get them to fight because we felt burned. Can't do it. And it's interesting that the overwhelming number of times that Eris is used in the New Testament, it is actually normally paired with the next word in the list, zelos, which I will translate in this case, envy. That desire that you have for what someone else has, or even the willingness to see it taken away from them so that you have it instead. This is mean. If you have ever received this behavior, you know it's mean. So let's not go crazy about Paul calling it out. But I looked a little into the psychological factors that are typically pinned down as undermining jealousy. And the answers make sense to me. Self-worth, stability, an unmet desire to be wanted or included, and relationship retention. All of those good and worthwhile and admittedly needed things are not going to be adequately acquired through brutal theft or through angry feelings. Envy will not increase your self-worth. Envy will not increase the stability of your life. Envy will not answer an unmet desire to be wanted or included. Envy will not practically aid in the retention of a desired relationship. So let's try not to do it, because it doesn't help any of the things that we actually try to use it for. It's a bad tool. And the last word, a plural noun, thumoi, thimi. I will translate that today, tantrums. Outbursts of anger, wrath, indignation, rage. James 1:20, I will remind you, says that man's anger doesn't achieve God's righteousness. Nothing can replace actually working through a problem. Anger is a response. It is a meaningful, indicative one. If you are angry about something, it is worth asking why. If someone else is angry about something, it is worth asking why. It is worth getting to the heart of the matter. But anger is a response. It is not a solution. It's just not. There is no thing about which you might be worthily angry that the anger itself will actually be the needed thing that happens in the end. Something's got to give, right? Somewhere. And I'll just throw in this free advice. For the last 2 to 3 years, all the studies that I have read on anger processing have excluded venting, rage rooms, even going for a run, as the primary recommended means of handling anger neurophysically. that which causes further arousal physically is not going to help you be less angry about something. So far, that's what studies have shown. It turns out that generally, the same methods that somebody would typically use to relieve stress are also those that seem to be most effective for calming anger. So, whatever you do to breathe, to simmer down, to take the load off, to lower the blood pressure, these are the ways, psychologically, based on current studies, these are the ways that you're actually going to get a hold of it. It's not finding all the right words for it that you know you would love to say. And it's not smashing something apart, and it's not running until something else hurts. That won't help. Now, those are all the words that we're going to cover today, and I very much appreciate your kind attention. God loves you so much. All these things that we've talked about today are the opposite of this list. If there is someone today, if you want to pray together today, let's do it. Tell someone you want to pray together with us today. If you want to become a Christian today, then let's have a conversation about what that looks like after worship is over. Let's stand right now and let's encourage each other with a song.